it is Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hey guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime. Time of year. I've finally gotten into the Christmas spirit, I think.
Okay.
It was a push. It was a last minute push to get there, but I'm there.
You're here and you're loving it.
And this episode is dropping on Christmas Eve.
Can you believe it? An episode on Christmas Eve.
Wow.
We're not taking
Merry
a break.
Christmas to
Merry
you.
Christmas.
No, we'll be off next week. I'm just kidding.
Probably.
No, actually, listen to this. So the case I'm going to tell you about today is brutal. But there was another murder almost a year later in the same town.
Oh.
And I'm going to tell you about that next week.
Okay.
So we're not taking next week off. Unless I die, in which case.
No.
Like.
No.
Lena could do it by herself.
I rebuke that.
Anyway, do you have
I'm sorry, the show must not go on.
The show must not go on.
If that happens.
Do you have all of your Christmas presents bought?
The majority. Okay. I think I've got like two and a half more.
All right. I do not. Thank you for asking.
Oh.
I do not.
I was thinking about going after this to get some stuff.
Yes. So I love Christmas shopping in person.
Yeah, I do too.
The past couple years, I've been doing a lot of it online. But I love going and picking up a present.
Yeah.
And bringing it home.
Yeah. That is one thing that I love about it. But the other thing is I look online and go to the store because I have to find the cheapest price.
Right.
I'm sorry. I'm frugal,
you
guys.
And Daniel, both. I'm just like, I don't care.
Yeah.
I'm going to order this
it's
from my
It's not that
bed.
I don't want to spend $50 on you, but if I don't have to,
well, yeah,
then I'm not going to.
Sure. Exactly. I mean, why would you?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I need to do some Christmas shopping tonight, which is not Christmas Eve for me. Luckily, this was recorded ahead of time. But I hope you guys have a beautiful Christmas.
Yeah.
If you celebrate, maybe you celebrate something else. My heart goes out to all of those families who were affected by the beach massacre just a couple days ago.
Yeah.
Shout out to the hero who helped stop the gunman.
Right.
That
was so amazing.
This just shows that, you know, we had Jewish people being targeted and a Muslim stopped this attack. I think it can open our eyes to how we're better together, and it doesn't matter what you believe in. We can all believe things that are important to us, and we can all
love each other
and protect each other.
Yeah.
So just let that sink in, and, you know, I saw that he has this GoFundMe that has raised over $1 million. And I was like,
are you serious?
Bless. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. The last I saw, it was like 1.2 or something like that million.
I mean, hero for sure.
I mean, can you imagine being like, I think if I, like, I am in a position where I can creep up on this guy, but he literally does it, and then he takes the gun away.
Yes.
Oh man, what a hero. My heart is broken for all of those families who were just celebrating their religion, their culture, and having a beautiful time with each other, and now this has happened to them. So,
so sad.
I am just heartbroken, heartbroken for the community, because you feel like you should be able to go rent out some pavilions. And I mean, how many times have we done that as a family?
Man. Yeah.
And express yourself and express your love in whatever way you want.
Yeah.
So I'm so sad for them. And I hope that everybody just can squeeze your family a little tighter this holiday season, whatever you celebrate. You know, reach out to the people you haven't seen or heard from in a while. It's just so sad.
Yeah. So, and take it as a reminder to be diligent and pay attention to your surroundings as well.
Right. Yes. So from one bad thing to another,
okay,
we'll just get into the story.
Bracing myself.
Yes. It was a beautiful warm night in Tallahassee, Florida on October 22nd, 1966. It was a little over a week before Halloween, but the holiday anticipation would have to wait because the Seminoles were playing Mississippi State at home. When the family that she was babysitting for got home from the game, Jenny Sims gathered her things and headed home. It was a quarter after 11 p.m., and her parents usually waited up for her to get back home. Mm-hmm. But as she walked through the door, she found the house relatively still. It was quiet except for a TV was on. I also saw some reporting that said a radio was on instead of a TV. But there was some chatter coming from, you know, the sports station. But nobody was near the TV or this radio. Hmm. It's like nobody was tending to it. So she quietly called out for her parents so as not to wake up her 12-year-old sister, Joy Sims, who should have been asleep by now. But again, there was nothing.
Weird.
No reply, no voices speaking softly in another room, just the sound of her footsteps as she went from room to room to room in the small ranch-style brick home.
That has got to be so unsettling.
Oof.
Gut-wrenching.
Right. Soon she made her way to her parents' bedroom, pausing briefly, hoping one more time to maybe hear some voices on the other side of that door before opening it and never being the same again.
Mm.
It's possible that the weirdest thing she expected to see was maybe her mother and father already tucked in for bed at night.
Okay.
You know, already asleep. But she didn't. Instead, she found her father, mother, and little sister laying in the room in pools of their own blood.
No.
Her father, Dr. Robert Sims, was laying on the bed with his hands bound. He was blindfolded.
Oh my gosh.
And blood saturated the floral bedspread beneath him. On the far side of the room was her mother, Helen Sims, lying on the floor, and just feet away from her was little Joy, bound and partially undressed.
Oh my gosh.
So naturally she darts from the room. She went straight to the phone book because, listen, it's the 1960s. There's no 911. So she looked up the number to the Beavis funeral home that was local. The town didn't have an ambulance service.
Oh my gosh.
But she knew that the Beavis funeral home did have an ambulance.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So she called them and she, you know, that was just like the logical step. Then, you know,
I wonder if her parents ever gave her, like, in case of emergency, this is what you do. I mean, we growing up, we had on our cabinet door, we had
the police station.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that is an interesting thing is, like, what did they do back in the day before 911? Did they have these emergency numbers posted? Did they have them memorized?
Right.
So she had also gone to school with the funeral director's son, Rocky Beavis, who worked with his dad from time to time. Rocky and his dad arrived at the Sims house like 7 minutes later after the call.
Wow.
And what they witnessed was absolutely soul crushing.
Oh my gosh, I could not imagine.
I mean, especially for poor old Rocky, who was just a teenager at the time.
Oh.
Now, of course, Rocky had seen dead people before.
Sure.
Okay. I mean, he'd helped in the mortuary business for a while, but this crime had just occurred. I mean, there was blood everywhere.
Mm.
Generally, when you think of a mortician dealing with blood, they're doing like embalming.
Right.
So it's a more controlled environment and they can, you know, compartmentalize things, but this is a whole nother level.
Right.
And this was his classmate's family. Like, how could this happen to someone he knows? Now, the Beavises were in shock, but they were the first to arrive on scene before police. So they knew they needed to take great caution when moving about that house.
Oh, good.
So former state's attorney Jeremy Mutz explained to the documentary 641 Muriel Court that they knew this was a crime scene and they didn't touch or move anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Willie Meggs, a Florida state's attorney, told the filmmaker as well that Tallahassee in the 60s was the type of town where, you know, people didn't lock their doors. And it sounds a little cliche when it comes to unassuming, sleepy little towns.
Right.
But Willie Meggs said that people didn't even lock their doors when they went on vacation.
What?
Or when they went out of town.
Girl, not me. I'm like, is the deadbolt locked? Is the back door locked?
Exactly. He just said, you know, they usually left the house open because their friends and family lived right around the corner.
Oh.
So, you know, whether they were dropping off mail or whether they were stopping by to drop something off, you know.
What a life.
It was just that kind of place. And in 1966, it was a small town. However, it was growing. They only had one McDonald's. They had one pizza joint, you know.
Yeah.
Kids were used to running around from house to house on foot and coming home when the street lights came up.
Hey, that was the life.
And listen,
that's how we grew up.
We got to grow up that way too. And I'm so thankful. The Sims, originally from Meridian, Mississippi, moved to Tallahassee. What? Wow.
That Who just, are we today?
I just went off the rails there. They moved to Tallahassee, Florida in the early 60s when Dr. Robert Wilson Sims got a job in the Department of Education. Now, I know it's hard to imagine that they had computers back in the 1960s, but they did have computers. They had machines that were computers, like early iteration.
Right.
So Dr. Sims' role was helping to integrate those machines into the education system.
Cool.
Which was so innovative for its time. And now look at us. We're giving our children iPads in kindergarten. Lord Jesus,
oh,
help me.
Oh, no.
So his wife, Helen Sims, worked at the First Baptist Church as a secretary. She loved to play the piano.
Aww.
So when things would slow down at church, she'd come out and people would poke their heads out of the office while she played. And they would just listen and have a moment because she was so very talented.
Oh, wow.
Now, I don't know if she played for the church. I think she just played, you know.
Leisurely.
Leisurely, yes. So the couple married very young and had three daughters, Jenny, who was 17, Judy, who was 16, Joy, who was 12. Now, Jenny and Judy had attended Leon High School and were very intelligent and dedicated students. The family was very plugged into their church, and in a small town, you know, you've got your church and school, and that's basically where you meet your people,
yeah,
your friends,
and
your future
everybody
husband.
Knows everybody. Remember, remember,
exactly. So that's your source of socializing. So it was a very, you know, and they also had like a little ravine behind their house where the kids would, you know,
that's so
hang
fun.
Out. It like butted up against their neighbor's property in the back.
That sounds so awesome.
It does. So, you know, they get called home for dinner and it was just that type of life. Now, Leon County Deputy Sheriff Larry Campbell was the first of law enforcement to arrive at the scene and became the lead detective on the case. It was his 24th birthday.
Oh,
that day.
Whoa.
And he was just getting off of his shift, like excited to go to a party.
He's just a baby.
He's like, I'm 24. I'm an adult. Like my frontal lobe is almost developed. I'm about to make decisions. And they're like, yeah, so, well, actually, they told him that he was getting called to a car accident with a fatality. That was the first message that came in when he was like headed out the door to get off of work. Like, actually, we need you to go check on this. And he was like, okay, well, ask such and such.
I got plans.
I'm headed somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And they're like, yeah, that's not how that works. So he was like, okay. So he he's on his way to this call when someone pops in on his radio and he learned that the incident was actually a homicide, not an accident, at the home of the Sims family, 641 Muriel Court. After hopelessly checking for signs of life, they discovered that 12-year-old Judy was already dead, but her parents were still breathing.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Robert's hands were bound, like I said. He was gagged and he was shot in the head.
Oh, my gosh.
Joy had been stabbed 7 times and her panties were pulled down, resting just above her knees. Helen's wrists and ankles were bound and she was gagged. Not only stabbed, but also shot.
What in the world?
Yes. Sadly, Dr. Sims died shortly after being found, and Helen was transported to the hospital and remained in a coma until she died from her injuries a couple days later. She never regained consciousness in order to answer any of the investigators' questions. Okay. You know, sometimes they're a little bit alert and they can
I was over here wondering.
A couple questions out of them, like, who did this? She never did. Mm. She was unconscious the whole time.
Man.
And you know, maybe that's a gift.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a gift that she never awoke to the nightmare.
Right.
But it's too bad that they weren't able to get some information from her, because they were starting to think that maybe the Sims may have known their attacker. When the sheriff and his other deputies arrived at the Sims home, starting, you know, to process the scene, they saw no signs of forced entry. Nothing was taken. I mean, Helen's purse was sitting out in the open on the kitchen counter, and her jewelry, both on her person and in her room, were untouched.
Huh.
So, this is weird.
Right.
However, just like the Blue Mound Massacre, episode 1, Cousins on Crime, the crime scene was not secured.
Oh, my gosh.
Police were coming in and out of the home and traipsing through the rooms. Friends and neighbors came over to the house. They were putting their cigarettes out in the Sims ashtray. Someone even took an ashtray from the home. I don't know whether it was a souvenir or just being like, well, they're not going to need this.
What?
I don't know.
I am appalled.
Right. Now, the funerals for the 3 members of the Sims family were held at their beloved church, First Baptist Church. Despite the fact that it was the largest church in town, it was packed wall to wall with people who wanted to pay their respects to the family. I mean, some reports make it sound like Robert and Joy had a joint funeral and then Helen had her own funeral.
Oh.
Some refer to the funerals.
Okay.
I couldn't find details about whether they were held together. So I'm assuming that she was in the hospital when the two, when Robert and Joy were buried, you know, had their funerals.
Right.
And then she passed and then she had a funeral.
Oh my gosh.
I don't know that for sure. That's just me speculating. But most reports say they all ended up together, buried back in Meridian, Mississippi, where they were from. Now, once the shock had worn off and the residents were past the funerals, they were desperate for answers. I mean, okay. Mm-hmm. You know, that grief kind of, that wave kind of washes over you. And then you're like, okay, but they were murdered. And by who?
Right.
They hadn't heard anything from the police, that they hadn't heard any progress being made in the case.
I mean, yeah, this is horrific. And yeah. I'm sure the town's like, what psycho is out here?
Right. And I get law enforcement's, you know, their motive behind keeping things close to the chest and saying, you know, we're only going to reassure the public, but I don't even think they were doing that.
Oh, man.
So because nobody was talking to them in law enforcement, they all started talking to each other. You know, they're trading tidbits of information.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Rumors started circulating through
town. Of course.
And people were scared. I mean, they were locking their doors now.
Oh, man.
And you know what? Some of them were buying locks because they didn't even have any locks.
Oh, my goodness.
Some people were buying additional locks.
Uh-huh.
And some people were buying guns.
Mm.
Women were even carrying water guns.
Oh, my goodness.
Just with ammonia inside. Just as some sort of...
I've never thought about doing that.
Yeah. That's not a bad idea. You know,
unless it leaks in your purse.
Right. Oh, that would be unfortunate. Yeah. I'd carry it around in a Ziploc bag and be like...
Hold on just a minute.
Sir, one moment. Let me open. But they were well aware that someone had come into someone's home that they lived near and murdered three people. One of them was a child who appeared to be sexually assaulted. You know, was that person in their town still? Were they walking among them? They didn't know.
Yeah.
The first individual that police looked at for the murders was... probably the most unlikely suspect, Pastor Cecil Albert Roberts.
What? Excuse me?
Of the First Baptist Church. Pastor Roberts, who went by C.A., was from Waco, Texas, and had gone to Baylor University. Upon completing his bachelor's degree, he, his wife, and his four children lived in Fort Worth while he attended seminary to get his master's and then Ph.D. After moving to Florida, he became the pastor at the First Baptist Church, and he was, you know, well-liked, charismatic, mesmerizing. You know, people would drive from all over to attend his sermons.
Interesting.
Yeah. And he also did something really interesting for the church in Florida. He led the First Baptist Church in Florida, which was one of the first to break segregation in the 60s. So he believed that black people, imagine this, black people just had the same rights that we did.
Oh, well.
I mean, they had the right to sit in church just like all the other white people did.
Of course they do.
And you know, the church initially was very resistant to this thought. You know, they thought, well, there's a reason why... there's still segregation. There's a reason. Okay, so they were very reluctant to say, well, I don't know that they should be able to sit next to us in service.
Goodness.
And they would vote and, you know, vote. And so the votes were no, pretty much.
Okay.
But he was eventually successful in this.
Really?
And the fact is that historically... him and some of the other pastors in the area are linked to the desegregation in churches.
That's
in Florida
pretty impressive.
At the time. It is. So why?
Uh-huh.
Like the fact that he's a pastor, that's unlikely in and of itself. But the fact that he was doing such good.
Yeah.
With all these wonderful things about him, why would they suspect him of a triple homicide? That's insane.
Yeah. I mean, what's the link there,
right,
other than being the pastor?
Well, he was on law enforcement's radar because Helen Sims had quit her job at the church just days before the murder.
Oh.
And while the true reason for her quitting isn't known, the rumor mill suggests that it was because Helen knew the pastor real, real well.
Okay.
So, you know, she was front and center. She was his secretary. And she saw all the women coming in and out of his office all the time.
Yeah.
So there was speculation that, well, she knew too much. Some in the community even accused her of having an affair with the pastor.
Oh, no.
I haven't
guilty seen, by association.
Right, I haven't seen anything to substantiate the fact that that rumor had any legs whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
I think when the community got wind that the police were looking at the pastor, all the other women, mm-hmm. Began phoning in and they were telling, I had an affair with the pastor. They started to say, but he had nothing to do with the murders. Like, he definitely wouldn't have done that. So after learning what kind of dirtbag the pastor really was, maybe he wanted to silence Helen, and her husband and youngest daughter just happened to be collateral damage. Like, maybe they were just there. But there's one big problem with him being the killer, though, because there is video footage of Pastor Roberts, who is also the team chaplain for the Seminoles.
Oh.
He was at the game that night.
What?
That's right. He's seen on the sidelines all through the game, all through the first half, and all through the second half. But what about halftime?
Oh, okay.
That's what it's called, right?
Yeah.
Halftime? Intermission?
Intermission.
Yay, sports. I just looked at you and I was like, halftime?
Yes, halftime.
Oh, what? Other chatter among locals was that they noticed that he came back to the game wearing something different.
What?
Yeah, that was just another rumor that was floating around.
Okay.
Well, because of all of this, police drove multiple different routes from the stadium that the Seminoles were playing at to the Sims home to see if they could make it back
by the
second half.
Yes. Okay. Look at you.
Look at me. I'm such a sports fanatic. But there's a problem here. They couldn't make it work. They took back roads. They took shortcuts. They sped. Mm. They went the speed limit. They went through traffic. They went through no traffic. And it just seemed like it was highly improbable. Like, just not possible for him to get there and back and be seen on the sidelines again in the second half.
On the time-stamped camera.
Exactly. So all in all, they said, we got to rule him out. I mean, we got to move on.
Yeah.
We can't just
focus.
Yeah, exactly. We have to look for the hands that took this family out.
Right.
He just couldn't have pulled it off in that amount of time. Now, in 1967, the pastor left Tallahassee because the word on the street was that he got an FSU student pregnant.
Shut up.
So he was pretty much shunned by the church at that point.
Was he married?
He was married with 4 children.
What the heck?
I mean, yeah.
I don't like that.
I know. So he was a scumbag. He was total scum. But him and his family moved.
And his family.
They moved back to Texas.
Loud.
And he taught at Stephen Austin University. Stephen F. Austin, I think it is. Just because he did good doesn't mean we can ignore all the bad things that he's done.
Mm.
Especially the things that he's done to hurt his family. Now, let's move on to the next suspect.
Okay.
Robert Howells. Robert Howells was married to a woman named Peggy. Peggy wrote a letter in the 1980s saying that the two of them went on a little honeymoon to Alligator Point the day after the Sims murder, and Robert told her that he'd murdered the Sims family.
Okay.
Okay, so he detailed the killings and even told her which order they were killed in, with Dr. Sims being the last to go, which is interesting to me.
So, hold on. He told her this the day after the murders, but she's sending the letter in the 80s.
Yes. So she writes this all down in the 80s. Now, police really wanted it to be this guy. They could wrap this up, reinstate Faith into Tallahassee, but there wasn't a motive. When questioned by police, Robert himself told them that he had met Helen at the grocery store, and he begins speaking with her, and either goes really good or really bad, because in his head he says, note to self, go kill that lady. Like,
right.
I either want her or
he just I had this her. Desire come over him.
It sounds a bit silly, but
it happens.
What about the other stuff that doesn't quite add up? I mean, I got to thinking about Dr. Sims being killed last, murdered last. Doesn't that seem odd to you? Like, wouldn't you kill the husband first?
Right.
So that he doesn't try to stop you from killing his wife and seemingly sexually assaulting his daughter. A gun he had didn't match the one used in the murders. His fingerprints weren't found at the scene, and he was adamant that he didn't do the killings. Robert Howells was very violent, so maybe Peggy's story was to, you know, maybe he was trying to scare her, essentially, by lying to her and telling her, mind your P's and Q's.
Did he ever say, did he ever admit that he told his wife that, but it wasn't true? Or was, do we know?
Yeah, I don't know.
Like, what if she sent in this letter to, like, out of spite, like, to help her get rid of him?
Yeah, I'm not sure. But I think the police were starting to think that Peggy was afraid of him. And so she either wanted him to be locked up because of this, like she really thought he did it, or, and perhaps he lied to her. Perhaps they were both in the wrong. I don't know.
Ooh, what now, a story.
I know. So there was another suspect in the investigation, Tommy Fulgham. Fulgham sounds like phlegm or something like that. So he lived two blocks south of the Sims residence. He was a sophomore at Leon High School at the time.
Oh.
Yes. And in 1978, when he was 29, he moved to Atlanta, Georgia, and he murdered his girlfriend. He kept her liver in a jar and disemboweled her. He cut off her hands. That's right.
Oh, my
Lord. He told some friends that he had the devil in him.
Well, it sounds like it.
Yeah. He became obsessed with religion and Satan and the paranormal.
Oh, man.
And he was a pretty normal kid by all accounts. He was in the choir in high school. He had two younger brothers. He just seemed normal. So everybody looking back and thinking, Tommy? I don't know. That just doesn't sound. But Tommy Fulgham ended up being at a party that night with many people vouching for him and his whereabouts.
Oh.
None of the prints at the crime scene matched Tommy's prints. And neither of the surviving Sims girls knew who Tommy was. So they may have gone to school with him, but they didn't really, like, they didn't know him. Their circles didn't cross. And they just thought, like, because police are thinking the Sims would have known their assailant.
Sure.
So they would have let him in. They didn't think that their parents would have let them in. And I don't think I mentioned this now, but the other sister, 16-year-old sister, was also babysitting that night. So she hadn't come home yet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Sorry about that. I'm a great storyteller.
That's so wild to think this happened and then he goes and moves and...
And then murders someone.
Right.
It's nuts.
Yeah.
Like, what are the odds? Well, then in 1987, a lady named Mary Charles LaJoy Fox, she went by Charlie.
That's cute. I like that.
As you should. came to the police with some new information. She saw a news article about the Sims murder and decided to come to Tallahassee to speak with investigators. Now, Charlie had a rough upbringing. She was adopted. Her adoptive parents were very abusive to her.
Oh.
Just a PSA. Don't adopt a kid if you don't want one.
Yeah. I mean,
okay.
I mean, why do we have to say that?
I mean, it feels like it doesn't need to be said, but well, back in 1965, she became obsessed with death. She used to visit the Beavis funeral home so much that they asked her to stop coming by.
What?
Yeah, I mean, she at first they were like, oh, you know, she's
she wants to learn in, how great,
you know, being a mortician, and you know, that's not everybody's cup of tea, so maybe we should nurture this. And they would answer her questions and show her around, but it was so frequent. They were like, and she started doing weird things in the funeral home, and so they asked her to stop coming by, but she
not
ended
a
up,
good look.
She ended up breaking in to the funeral home a couple times and stealing like burial shrouds. And
that was
really concerning.
This
to
has
them.
Become an obsession, right. A fetish.
Yeah.
Oh goodness.
And so Charlie was an odd duck. She only really had one friend as a teenager, and that was Vernon Fox. As you can tell from her name, they eventually married. So his family upbringing was just as dysfunctional as Charlie's. Neither of their families approved of them dating because they're like, ew. And the other family was like, ew. And they were both right. They were both ew. But they didn't care. They dated anyway.
Yeah.
They were
going to do what I
around
want.
Behind their, you know, family's backs.
Ugh.
His father was actually a criminologist who taught at FSU. But he was nuts.
Oh.
Yes. He was an alcoholic, you know, and all the consequences that come along with that.
I just want to say FSU, there's a lot going on there.
Well, back in the 60s, there was. That's for sure. The house that Vernon grew up in, their property backed right up to the Sims property. There was no fence separating them or anything.
Oh.
Right. It was like a big green space back there.
Okay.
So there had been some reports in the area of a prowler before the murders.
Oh.
Interestingly, these reports coincided with when Vernon was in town from being in the military.
Oh.
And then they stopped when he would go back to where he came from.
Okay. We're noticing a pattern here.
Right. So we're having these little things lining up. Vernon told Charlie that a neighbor saw him peeping in on Joy Sims about a week before the murders. This is what Charlie's telling the detectives.
Oh.
She's saying, you know, he tells me that he was a peeping Tom and he got caught. So Charlie's at the police station. She's talking to the police for something like 6 hours.
In the 80s.
No. Yeah, 89. Hang on, 87. And she said, maybe I went and killed that family so Vernon wouldn't get in trouble.
Oh.
And now they're like, what?
No.
She said, you know, the night of the murders, they were at the movies. They were supposed to stay for two movies, but the ticket taker remembered seeing them. There. And he remembered, he knew them, and he remembered them leaving after the first movie.
Oh.
Yeah. So the couple was questioned back then.
Oh.
Back then, because they were weird. They were a weird couple.
Yeah, you might want to check these two
right,
out.
Exactly. The couple was questioned back then, and they each told a different story about what they were doing on the night of the murders. This was only 4 days after the murders when they were questioned. You'd think you'd remember whether you stayed for one movie or two.
Yeah, I think I stayed.
4 days later. Yeah. Anyway, Vernon says they stayed till the end of the movie, Munsters, but they left at the end of the football game and they went to a secluded park and had sex in the car.
Okay.
Charlie said they left the movie and went straight home.
Oh.
She said, I can't remember if we stayed till the second movie or not, but we went straight home. Now, Vernon goes on to say that he and Charlie were walking home when they saw a car with the high beams coming down the street, and they thought that was weird.
Okay.
Okay. Well.
Deflection.
That was back in the 60s when they're giving all this story.
Right.
Okay. Well, now it's 1987. Charlie's being interviewed. She denies that she slept with Vernon until she was 19 years old. So that would have been the following year.
So someone's lying.
Right. So 1987, Vernon's also re-interviewed because they're like, Charlie is dreaming, or we got to talk to Vernon. Let's just see what he says. And so now he's adding some more to the story. Not necessarily changing it, but adding.
Okay.
So the story about the car that they saw that night with the headlights coming down the street. Now he says the car stopped right next to them.
Oh.
Okay.
So did you get a good look at this person?
And the back door opens, he says.
Get in.
Then
sorry.
He's re-interviewed in 2016.
Oh.
And he says the car stopped, the door opened, and they said, "That's not our guy." They shut the door and they sped away. So it's like each time he's interviewed, he's adding things. Oh, and Charlie swears that she saw the car too. She saw this car with the high beams on. She, you know, every time she's interviewed, she vouches for that. Vernon said that, yeah, you know, I did go home. I made myself a sandwich. I went to my room and I watched TV. Well, about that time that he said he was in his bedroom watching TV is about the same time that the ambulance would have arrived at the Sims residence. Oh. And a neighbor back in the 60s recounted seeing Vernon on the street while the sirens were coming down the street, meaning he was still out on the street while the ambulance was coming.
He hadn't even made it home to make his sandwich.
Right. And you know how long it takes a man to make a sandwich, or a teenage boy anyway. Now, towards the end of the conversation, Charlie asked the detectives what would happen to her if she was arrested for the crime. And as soon as they mentioned going to maybe a mental health facility, she got very concerned about that.
Oh.
She asked, well, can I collect the $10,000 reward for solving the crime and then maybe go to a private health facility?
Oh my. Did they laugh in her face?
Well, you know, here's the thing. That sounds nuts. Okay. She probably does need to go get sorted out.
Yes.
But no matter what she said, it was like six something hours. Six, seven?
Oh, no, don't do it. Don't. No, ma'am.
Six, seven hours that she was in that interrogation room talking to police. Whatever she said to them was being questioned or speaking. Whatever she said to them, it was enough to sound like a confession.
Okay.
But it was not enough to actually be one. So she was never charged with any involvement in the crimes. She never gave any details about the murders. It was like, you know, there was no evidence against her. And it wasn't a real confession. She was just talking. She was saying, what if I did that to protect him? What if I did that so he didn't get caught? What if it was me? She never... You know what I mean?
Yeah. There's something going on there, though.
Yeah. So Vernon stands by his statement that he had nothing to do with the murders, because if she didn't do it, you know, now they're starting to piece things together that he was seen on the street while the ambulance was coming down the street. You know, he was out that night. They left before the second movie. Like,
yeah.
But... to listen to both of them talk, it's just like, wow, I just thought you couldn't be any dumber than her. And I thought he could be any dumber than you.
Oh, but no.
Somehow, that's why they were each other's only friends. And that's why they got married, because they were nuts. Police searched high and low for the gun used in the crime. They searched waterways. They searched for the knife used to stab Helen and Joy. They tested guns that they found from members in the community. Nothing was a match. Nothing.
What in the world?
The murder of the Sims family still hangs over Tallahassee like a black cloud. It has gone unsolved.
What?
All of this time. No matter how long and no matter how much time has gone by, it seems like they get further and further away from the truth. And just like we talked about in the Blue Mound Massacre, you cannot go back. You've got one shot, one opportunity. Get in there, secure the freaking scene, take pictures, yeah. Take notes if you don't have a camera, don't move anything.
Oh, man.
Don't let people in.
No. Or take things.
Right. Don't let people take things. Don't let people stick their fingers in the bullet holes in the wall. That was the Blue Mound Massacre.
Oh, no.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here. And if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
So in 2016, Vernon, you know, I mentioned that he was interviewed again. Well, in 2016, a woman named Patricia Sunday, who was a school superintendent candidate, said she knew who killed the family.
What the heck?
In 2016.
But here we are.
Right. Why now? She said she was 19 years old when she said a woman confided in her about the murders. She wouldn't name this woman, but this woman told her everything that happened in the murders. Patricia claims that she told police about it all that time ago.
Okay.
That's right. She's saying, I did tell police back then.
But why won't you tell her name now?
So the recent firing of Assistant Leon County State's Attorney Jeremy Mutz, who I mentioned earlier, caused her to come forward again. Because Jeremy Mutz told WCTV that there was enough evidence to arrest someone in this case.
What?
He said he began looking into the case when he stumbled across a box of records in 2015. Mr. Meggs, who was state's attorney, said that Jeremy was obsessed with the case. He said, you know, he pushed for modern technology to be used. And he and Jeremy alleged that Mike Woods, who's also in the investigation, and Mr. Meggs refused to test this evidence or reinvestigate the case.
Oh, that's not good.
Now, state's attorney, Mr. Meggs, said, well, the evidence was submitted to a lab and we're still waiting for analysis.
Okay, what lab do we know?
Right.
And here we are.
Waiting for now. Listen, we know how long that can take.
Not 10 years, 11 years.
Well, he wasn't specific about when the testing was submitted. But I think he was saying that to maybe appease or by time. There is something political going on in that office, or was back when this documentary was created in 2017. So, as I said, Jeremy Mutz, who worked as a state's attorney, he was pushing for this case to be, you know, he was all fired up about this. He was like, here's the evidence, let's do testing. And for some reason, he doesn't know why, he was blocked. There's something weird going on there.
Yeah,
I don't know.
There's no reason to block it. I mean, why are you blocking him from doing his job from getting justice for this family?
Yeah. It's interesting. I don't know if they butted heads or if they just didn't like each other as colleagues or what it was. But that's why Patricia came forward again, because she was like, this is not justice. Like, I know this information, and this information has been shared with the state's attorney's office, and they're doing nothing about it.
Oh, man.
Unfortunately, nothing has come of that.
Obviously.
Right. So as far as I know, that's pretty much where we end. Is 2017, this documentary was created. It's very interesting. You can watch it on Vimeo. Oh. If you just Google 641 Muriel Court documentary, it'll come up.
Oh, okay.
But it's free to watch. It's this case is wild because it just seems like it went cold so fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't till years and years later that they started backtracking and going, oh, like when, you know, the Phlegm guy killed his girlfriend, and they're like,
he
lived in that area at that time. He went to the high school with the two older girls. It just seems like time went on and on and on, and they were retroactively investigating. But it's too late at that point, I feel like.
Yeah, it's such a heinous crime that you would think there was DNA all over. I mean, of course, this was the 60s, so did they know what evidence to keep for DNA? Surely they did.
Yeah, I don't know, because I think we weren't, you know, we weren't talking about DNA and things like that until the 80s. Like,
true.
It's odd to me.
But there's so many cold cases from back in the 60s and 70s that are getting solved these days because of DNA.
Right.
So I feel like they knew to keep things, like, so something was coming to be able to help solve these cases. I feel
I think that they lucked out in a lot of cases. Like,
okay,
maybe DNA was found. Maybe all those years later, when in the 80s, you know, because DNA was actually used to solve a case in England in the 80s.
Okay. Yeah.
So before we got there,
yeah,
they beat us to most things. But it's interesting that you say, like, did they have an inkling that they should have kept things? It doesn't feel like there was much evidence collected.
It was such a small town.
It was such a small town. And listen, I don't want to talk smack about the 24-year-old who was turning 24 and he just wanted to go home. Like, I don't suggest that he was lazy in that regard. I don't know that they were equipped to deal with something like this.
Yeah, I can agree with that.
They had very limited training, basic training, and nothing like this had ever happened under his watch. He was the first, you know, one to get there at the time. I'm sure he did his best, okay? But it does, from all the reports that I'm getting, it doesn't seem like there's talk of the evidence. Mm. It doesn't say, like, oh, you know, the gag that was in Helen's mouth, like, had this, or we found a hair on this, or all or that's really talked
that
about.
That Joy was sexually assaulted. Like,
that's
maybe
the
we
thing,
should.
Is there's not much reporting about what was done to Joy, which I don't need the details.
No.
But
is,
let me say
is
something.
Is there DNA there?
Is there DNA? Of course. But what does that say about this massacre? The fact that Joy's panties were pulled down, mm-hmm. not Helen's.
Right.
I think Joy was the target here. I think Joy was the target. I think her parents were tied up when someone was caught entering their home. Maybe she was being assaulted and she ran into her parents' room. And that's when they were bound. Maybe there was more than one person there.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. So, throughout everything that you've said, the most plausible that I can think of are the two with
the couple,
the husband and wife with the mental issues. He was known to be a peeping Tom. He's looking through Joy's window and he wants to get in that house to her.
And he had, listen, I don't know that we can really believe a whole lot of Charlie, she says, but she says that he was interested in little girls.
Well, and he probably was like, you're coming with me. You're going to help me get the this mom and dad tied up.
Or we're going to kidnap her. And I don't know how it all went down, but it makes more sense that she's the target because she's the one who's sexually assaulted here.
Right.
You know, and the mom, I don't know. It's just like, why wouldn't you rape the adult woman?
Right.
Obviously, this person has a tendency towards children.
Right.
So that is a basic fact of the crime. Why are they not? That feels like.
It really baffles my mind that you've had several people come forward.
Right.
And it's still a cold case.
Yeah.
Like, you have these people saying...
Over the years. Like, 20 years later.
I feel like this case is very solvable.
I do, too. And if they have anything, I think it could be solved.
Yeah.
But I mentioned at the top of the episode, there was another murder.
Mm-hmm.
In 1967, in Tallahassee, Florida, two teenage girls were murdered. And I'm going to tell you about that next week.
Okay.
It's not necessarily a two-part episode. It's just that, are they linked? Were there similarities?
Right.
We'll talk about it.
Oh, I can't wait to hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man.
But here's the thing is, I can't get over the fact that there was a sexual component to this crime, and it seems to be ignored in all reporting.
Yeah.
Nobody's talking about that. They're glossing over it. I know it's difficult to talk about things like that, but that to me feels like an essential fact of the crime. That feels like something you put in a profile.
Oh, absolutely.
So that seems like
That's the motive. That seems like big motive here.
That feels like the stick which you measure the suspects by.
Right.
Okay.
Does this person have a burglary history? Nothing is missing.
Right. And nobody locked their doors. Okay.
Right.
They were expecting their daughters home.
Right.
From babysitting. Just because there was no forced entry doesn't mean someone didn't just turn the knob and open the door.
Yeah.
I really can't stand when they say there's no sign of forced entry.
Because, I know.
You know what I mean?
People leave their doors unlocked.
And also, people open their doors for strangers. If someone comes to the door, knocks on your door, you open the door and you say, can I help you?
Right.
Maybe they've come in your house.
Right.
Maybe they barge in.
Mm-hmm. This is so aggravating.
Yeah. I could go on. I encourage everyone to go watch that documentary because it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Charlie's interview, like the little clips that they play of her interview, it's strange. You can definitely tell she had a rough childhood.
Mm.
She's got some mental health issues. But that doesn't mean she's lying. That doesn't mean she's misremembering.
Yeah.
Or making things up. We can't discount.
For me, the thing is, she says, well, maybe I did it.
Right.
And I think that's, I feel like that's a confession. Like, it happened.
Maybe
he did it, but I want to tell you that I did it because I want to protect him.
Or maybe she was there. Or maybe he told her about the crime. And all these years later, you remember when we were sitting there talking to my dad? This was years ago. We were teenagers. And I said something like, hey, remember that time we da da da? And you were like, no. And my dad was like, what? And I have memories. I have memories. I still think about things to this day.
Yeah.
They're not real. I dreamed them.
Oh, really?
I have very real dreams. And my dreams become memories. So maybe this is a case where she has concocted in her mind, or she misunderstands the situation.
Hmm.
That's why she's saying out loud, talking out loud, maybe I did it. Maybe I did it. Well, what would happen if I had done it? You know?
Yeah.
Maybe she's even confused herself. But I think there's something there, something to it.
To me, that's the most...
And Vernon, the fact that he was never, you know, like, the, I mean, what? I don't understand. Like,
so, yeah.
Fingerprints are the only thing that they say, you know, they don't match. They don't match the fingerprints. Well.
And so they're putting everything been, on the fingerprints.
Couldn't have been wearing gloves. I mean, couldn't have missed some fingerprints. I don't know. Was the 1960s.
My goodness. And you know, the whole, at first I thought the boy that was a sophomore when he was there and then moved and killed his girlfriend, mm-hmm. like that sounds very promising, but at the same time, on the other hand, it's a sophomore boy.
Right.
Going in and binding up two adults, and then
so what that feels
I just can't
like,
see that
it is what this feels like is kind of onset schizophrenia. Like he's starting to say things like, I have the devil in me.
Oh,
you know, because onset is usually like in the 20s, you know, can be in late teens, 20s, sometimes later in life. And so he's normal this whole time. He doesn't have any history of being weird with little kids, or no violent history, nothing with animals or anything like that, that would, he would just murder three people and sexually assault a child.
Right.
So, but that is a weird coincidence. I will say that is very strange.
It is.
That he's,
everything in this case is really strange.
It is. And I think that's why it's still not solved, because there are tiny little flickers of links to all these different things, but nothing seems to make sense.
Let me add them. I want to see these folders.
Right. Yeah. Send us the case files. We should do a FOIA request.
Oh.
We should FOIA this case. But yeah, I mean, this has me just absolutely gutted that it's gone all this time.
Yeah.
The Blue Mound Massacre is still not solved. So,
I know.
it's just wild that...
I feel like it is solved, but it's not solved.
Right. Right.
Let's just say that.
Let's just say it that way.
Well, I can't wait to hear next week's, because maybe that'll give some kind of insight.
Well, we'll see.
Okay. Holy moly. I don't even know where to end this, because there's just, I feel like we could keep on talking about it. Write us, message us, and tell us what you think. Like,
what do you think?
Have you stuck out the most?
Yeah. Have you heard this case covered anywhere else?
Uh-huh.
Do you know something we don't know? Tell us. We want to know.
Wow. Okay. So, Jenny and...
Joy and Judy.
Man, Judy and Jenny.
Yeah.
I hope they're doing well.
There's not, and that's the other thing, is there's not much reporting on them, and like, did they move? Did they, whose care were they under? It's just, it's, I think they were so focused on chasing their tails for so long.
Yeah.
It's wild. It's a interesting one.
Well, I hope they're doing well. I thank you for telling of this family. I mean, it's just a super sad story, but maybe one day they'll have justice.
I hope so.
Well, that was great. Let's do it again next week.
Let's do it. See you next week, guys.
Bye, y'all.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. Get connected with us by becoming a free member on our Patreon. Or for just $5 a month, you'll have access to bonus episodes, discussion groups, and much more. If you can't afford $5 a month, we get it. Inflation, am I right? Please consider leaving us a positive review and rating wherever you listen.
And don't forget merch. Support our podcast and show the love by sporting t-shirts with our latest designs or grab an evidence bag to keep the chain of custody for all your valuables. Don't forget to follow our show on your favorite streaming app so you never miss an episode, and get photos and updates on our Instagram at Cousins on Crime Podcast or our Cousins on Crime Facebook page. Have a case suggestion? Email us at cousinsoncrime@gmail.com.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save